Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon, tennis world. March 7th, 2013, coming to you on the Bruce Lipka Show on Blog Talk Radio on the UR Tennis Network. Our guest today, Associate Head Coach at the University of Notre Dame, Ryan Satchery. Ryan was a former All-American at Notre Dame, world-ranked ATP player, won titles in singles and doubles on the Challenger and Future levels, and most importantly, Ryan is going to be taking over the helm as the head men's tennis coach at the University of Notre Dame after Bobby Bayless retires this spring. We're going to have a great show today. If you have any questions, our call-in number 714-583-6853. Stay with us for a quick commercial. We'll be back in 60 seconds with Ryan.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Folks, welcome back to the show. We have our guest today, Associate Head Coach at University of Notre Dame, Ryan Satchery. Ryan, you there with us?
I'm here, Bruce. Thanks.
Hey, thanks for coming on the show today. You guys, I know you're in the middle of your season and things are a little busy, but I appreciate you taking a little bit of time out today and spending lunchtime with us.
Absolutely. Couldn't be more excited to be on here with you and help the show out in any way I can.
Well, thank you so much. Well, let's go back to, you know, tennis being a big part of your life now, and obviously it's your livelihood, but it's also your passion. You know, where was your introduction to tennis? Where did it begin?
Well, it began at a place called the Borman Tennis and Swim Club when my parents had just had me, obviously, and I was a young kid, and they would play as something to do together as a couple, and they obviously took me there with them when I was 3, 4, 5 years old, and slowly but surely began, you know, jumping in on the court with them and hitting balls back and forth. And the ironic story about that was my dad was always a football player. He was an offensive lineman in college and had a short pro career with the San Diego Chargers, and he learned tennis when he met my mother, ultimately, and something to do with her as a date or, you know, something to share in common. And actually, he then just absolutely fell in love with the sport. And he was, until I got here to Notre Dame and started working with Coach Bayless, he was the only true coach I had growing up through juniors. And he learned the game and became extremely passionate about the game by reading books and watching videotapes. And so here's a guy that never played a competitive junior match in his life or college match or pro match ever, but went on to grow a great love for the game of tennis and still teaches it and coaches it at a relatively high level to this day.
That's absolutely fascinating. And this was all in Ohio?
This is all in Northeast Ohio, yep, absolutely.
So you're growing up in Northeast Ohio, where winter is winter, and dad's the coach, and that's a tricky relationship as it is to begin with, trying to parent your kids and coach them. I can't handle it. But what went on in the wintertime? I mean, were you playing indoors, or did you take the winters off, play other sports? What happened in the winter?
Yeah, good question. You know, when I was young, obviously, real young, between the ages of, you know, 6 to 12, I played a bunch of other sports, and many of them were obviously in the winter. Played basketball, played soccer. You know, I still love tennis. I love the hand-eye coordination aspect of it. I love hitting balls. And my dad and I would, when I was real young, would go down to our basement and hit on the backboard of one of the walls down in our basement, and he'd toss me balls, and I'd had a sawed-off wooden racket and hit balls that way. And you know, it kind of got really grassroots introduction to the game. And then obviously as I became older and got a little bit better at the game, yeah, obviously then the training took place year round, and I did have an indoor club in Youngstown, Ohio, that I practiced at all the time and played tournaments and fed from there. But the beginning stages, I did play a ton of other sports and just kind of fit tennis in when I could.
When did you make the commitment and just start to play the tennis full time?
When I got to high school. I played basketball up through middle school, and to be honest with you, Bruce, I wanted to play in high school as well. Our high school always had a great basketball program, and to be on the team and to do what I needed to do on the basketball end of things, what I had to really take a major step back in my training for tennis, and, you know, in terms of practicing and no tournaments for 4 months. And I kind of knew at that time, when I was in ninth grade, that tennis was sort of the vehicle that was going to get me to the best college and give me the best options to, if I wanted to play pro tennis, that would be the best sport for me to do it in. And so I thought long and hard about it. I actually went through the off-season conditioning program with basketball and went right up to the point where we were getting ready to go in the season and just kind of had to pull out and say, you know, look, the time commitment to do the basketball the right way was just too much to give up on the tennis aspect of things. That's when I made the solo jump to tennis.
Now, here on the Bruce Lipka Show, we have a time machine, and we're fortunate to have it. So we get to travel back in time sometimes and look at things. If you're doing it all again, would you have taken a season or two to play basketball and kind of stoke that passion, or you think it's all good that you didn't play in high school?
I think I made the right decision. You know, ultimately in tennis and when you were at Miami of Ohio, you obviously recruited me and you know a little bit of the chronology.
You don't have to bring up sore spots. You don't have to bring up sore spots. You just let those things lie.
Hey, you were my favorite phone call every week, and I say that with all sincerity, and you were a fantastic recruiter, and I definitely considered Miami of Ohio. But no, you know, it was the right time for me to focus on my tennis. I was a late bloomer. I wasn't, you know, I've always been tall for my age and wasn't the most coordinated, let's say, growing up. And so my junior ranking back in the 12s and certainly even younger than that was way below what you'd typically expect someone who's going to end up playing at Notre Dame and then on the pro tour to be. And so I needed all that time on the court that I could get. And, you know, so while I do think that just teaching me how to compete, it was really, really important for me to play basketball, to play soccer, to play baseball, all the sports that I did play, I do think I made the right decision. And ultimately, you know, what you worry about when you have someone, and we still worry about it at this level too, when we have kids that join our team that maybe played other sports in high school, is you worry about burnout. You worry about when someone commits 110% of their time to tennis and they don't have that release in another sport, another activity, is it too much? And it to this day, it still never is too much for me. And so I think I did make the right choice and really benefited from being able to go full bore in the tennis.
Well, we know that the thing about tennis that's so unique for me, and as you're, you know, as you're several years into a coaching career, but, you know, a lot of the people who are in a coaching career, maybe they don't take into consideration that all of the years they spent as a junior player and as a college player and a pro player, all that experience, it all brings to you, you know, certain instincts that go along with it. So we're all, you know, we're individual athletes. We play this sport, and it's so different for everybody. It's tough to take a sweeping brush stroke and say, well, you know, all tennis players might burn out or they might not burn out, or, you know, it's everyone's an individual. But looking at yourself, had we also had the chance to get back in our time machine and go back in time, Is there anything you would have tried to infuse into your foundation as a tennis player at a younger age that would have served you well when you were trying to reach your potential as a professional and, you know, perhaps breaking into the top 100 versus, you know, being a 300 singles player and 180 doubles player? Is there something that you would have needed to do better that would have been introduced to you at a younger age that you wish you could do again?
Sure. Just to kind of expand on the background of where I came from and what I was exposed to when I was a kid was, you know, again, my dad was my coach, and it was really, really good in that regard. He knew I was never going to dump him as my coach, and so, because he was the one that was paying the bills, obviously, and so there was no security aspects, there was no jealousy aspects, and what I felt like really benefited me a ton was he would take me up on a given Saturday or a given weekend, even both days, Saturday, Sunday, and I would go work with other coaches for a couple of days. And just, you know, the theory that he always instilled in me, and I firmly believe this to this day, is you can learn something from everybody. And, you know, while I say my dad was my coach, there were a number of people in Northeast Ohio, Don Stevens, Rich Mastardi, Bob Bird, you know, people that were teaching pros and did a great job, and they all had an impact in terms of my development. And they may have said the same thing four different ways, and it was the same thing my dad was teaching me, but one of them maybe clicked, you know, in terms of what I understood, and maybe I shot up in that regard of my game, that aspect of my game, because of what they said. And so exposure to different coaches, to other ways of looking at things was important, and my dad also empowered me to be the one that was the ultimate decision maker. Does this feel right for you? Do you get this? Do you agree with this? And so, you know, I think the danger in exposing yourself to multiple voices is that you can sometimes get a little bit cluttered mentally. But if you're strong enough mentally and mature enough to be able to sift out the information that maybe doesn't make sense to you and go with what does, no matter who it came from, I think you can certainly benefit from everybody. The one thing I would have, if I was coaching myself back at that time, I think I would have exposed myself to a little bit more international play. It wasn't all that big back in the 90s when I was growing up as a junior tennis player to play ITFs. But I did think that was a little bit of an adjustment that I had to get used to, and not necessarily the travel, but just even playing international competition. There's a little bit of fear sometimes of the unknown, and I wasn't exposed to players from different countries. And so I got that a little bit of that in college, and certainly played my fair share of international players here. But when I went out and played the Pro Tour, that's basically all you're playing against is international competition, unless you're playing a challenger or a future in the U.S. where there's more Americans. But just being a little bit more familiar with tendencies, patterns, styles that you can kind of make generalizations about certain countries, and I was learning on the fly, I felt like, as a pro, whereas if I had a little bit more, maybe just 10% of my tournament schedule, would have traveled a little bit more and had some experiences out of the country, I think that would have helped.
Tactically, what was your style of play? I mean, I'm assuming that if your dad was an offensive lineman for even a brief period in the NFL, he's not a small person, so it wasn't a shock to anybody that you grew to be as tall as you are. Were the tactics that you were trying to learn as a young man ones that would fit the body type that you were assuming you were going to grow into?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And I don't know that it was done done on purpose, but, you know, my natural game style, my natural tendencies, I guess, is just as a human being is relatively aggressive, and I played a very aggressive baseline style. I didn't serve and volley much. I wish I would have developed my net game a little bit more when I was a young kid and become more comfortable doing that. But, you know, I played relatively close to the baseline. I played a pretty physical style of game, hit the ball relatively clean and hard, and tried to push people around off the ground and then ultimately get into the net. And where I really learned tactics was when I came to Notre Dame. And, you know, Coach Bayless is if there's anybody in the world better at tactics than him, you know, I'd like to meet them because he really – put the kind of the finishing touch. You know, I felt like I had the technique relatively down pat in terms of especially the serve and the ground strokes. And when I got here to Notre Dame, he helped me learn how to put all that together, all those tools together. And ultimately, my style became a somewhat all-court player as time went on. And he insisted upon me coming in more and more and more and learning how to serve and volley maybe a quarter of a time or a tenth of a time based on the matchup on that given day. But, you know, always my bread and butter was hitting big ground strokes from the baseline relatively close and then working my way in.
Once you got out of high school and you come to Notre Dame and you finished your junior career, where'd you finish up in the juniors, your last year 18s?
My highest national ranking ever was my last year of 18s, and I was 20 in the country.
So that's a trend that we like to see. You know, as a coach, you like to see players moving toward their highest rankings in the 18s, not in the 14s. You head to Notre Dame, you go to college, and now this is a completely different dynamic. You don't have to go out and hit with your dad anymore. You don't have to drive anywhere on the weekend to have lessons. You don't have to find games during the week. You just show up at the courts every day. What's that like compared to what you'd been doing in the juniors?
It was incredible. I mean, and that's the one really tremendous benefit, player development benefit, that a campus style like Notre Dame has is, you know, we're fortunate enough to have our own facility here on campus, and our campus is relatively enclosed. It's an efficient, you can keep it a very efficient schedule here. And so just having the option, the opportunity to, you know, come in and do a private lesson with Coach Bayless or whoever our assistant coach was at the time for an hour in between classes and then come in back for team practice later in the day and you know, having obviously several great teammates that were also extraordinary players and motivated players, and you know, you're practicing in that environment every single day. It's a tremendous boost from what you're used to as a junior player. But like I said, the biggest thing was I was able to get a ton of tennis in, just because from getting from point A to point B here is relatively seamless, and the opportunity to play a lot of tennis and play a lot of great tennis you know, against great competition was hugely instrumental in my development.
What about the people who say that, who've talked this whole generation of kids from, you know, Timmy Smicek and all these kids who skipped college and went pro, who maybe believe that you can't go to college and play pro tennis, but, you know, what about that thought? Is there a place in college tennis? Does college tennis have a place, whether it's a year, two, three, or four, for someone who aspires to be a professional and make a living on the pro tour?
Yeah, there's no question about it. And I think that theory, both domestically and internationally, is getting debunked, that college tennis is not a pathway to the pros. I think that's absolutely getting proven wrong. You look at one of our best players in program history was a kid named Stephen Bass, who graduated in 2007, and Stephen was ranked around sixth in the country that year. And, you know, just some of the names that were that he played that year in college tennis were John Isner, Somdev Devarman, Jesse Levine, Kevin Anderson, Arno Brugis. All those guys are top, you know, obviously Isner's top 10, Kevin Anderson's top 50, Levine's top 100, Devarman is top 100 as well. I mean, that's four guys right there. Brugis is top 200 that, you know, are successful pros. And so when you're playing the highest level national events and you're playing those guys you can't tell me that you're not going to get better playing college tennis. And just the resources that we have, the abilities to train, the abilities to practice, you know, the salaries among college coaches is getting higher and higher and higher. So you're attracting better and better coaches to the profession. You know, absolutely, it's a pathway to successful pro careers. I do think that it's necessary during the summer months to go out and play the professional events, so you're getting exposed to an even higher level of play than maybe you see it typically on a daily basis in college. But there's no doubt that it's certainly a very widely considered logical next step for most kids. Now, you have your exceptions. Jack Sock probably made the right decision to turn pro. Ryan Harrison probably made the right decision to turn pro. I don't think there's one umbrella for everybody, but certainly by and large, it's the right path. And you look at a guy like Stevie Johnson, how much development and progress he made in college, he wouldn't be anywhere near where he is right now if he went straight to play pro tennis.
You know, I mean, I think you played in the finals of maybe the All-American, one of the tournaments. Didn't you play Blake when you were in college?
I did. I played James a couple times. and unfortunately came in second place in both of those matches. But yeah, we played in the finals of the All-American Championships, and then our two teams played in the NCAA team tournament, and we played each other at the number one single spot in that match as well.
Now, were you thinking when you played this guy and you lost him a couple times, this guy's going to be ranked as high as four in the world someday? Was it apparent to you that this is where he could be going?
No, because I don't know that it's a – I'm a believer, Bruce, that there's a group of guys that are have enough talent to be successful pros. And that group might be, you know, if we're talking, you know, to get in the top 100 in the world, there might be 500 players out there that can do it. And beyond that, it comes down to after the talent level, you know, once you get in that pack, then it comes down to the decisions that you make. Are you staying healthy? The schedule that you play, the improvement that you keep making as your career develops, all those things, I think, is what separates the guy that's 100 from the guy that's 500. Now, you're talking James Blake was a whole different level than that. And you could see the athleticism that he had. You could see the shot-making skills that he had. But I don't know that you ever sit there and say, okay, that guy's for sure going to be top five, just because there's so many things that can go wrong. There's so many variables. Like I said, health is a huge one. And being able to play a sustained schedule and then how are you going to do on the tour when you've had a month where you lose 70% of your matches. Let's say you only win two matches in a month, and everybody has it. Unless your name is Nadal, Federer, Djokovic, everybody's had those kind of months. And what's your psyche going to be like after that month? Or is it going to motivate you and make you more determined to be better, or is it going to kind of discourage you a little bit and get you down on yourself and where you lose confidence? And those things I don't think can be truly determined until you get out there and the bullet starts flying live. And James did a phenomenal job as a pro, and he's one that kind of fit all the things that I said. He stayed healthy throughout the majority of his career. He improved a ton as he got out there on the tour. He was smart about his schedule, and he was mentally tough. And you know, you put that formula together, and you take somebody that has the talent that he had to get to that range, you know, that's when great things happen, and they did for him.
Well, you talk about, you know, entering into the pro ranks and early on, and, you know, a lot of the people who listen to us, they're tennis enthusiasts. They play in leagues. They, you know, hear about, you know, a show about tennis. They listen in, but they don't really understand. For me, it's always been trying to shed some light on people on how truly difficult it is to be a tennis player. And what I mean by that is if you came out of college and the Los Angeles Dodgers signed you to play baseball in their organization, you show up the first day with your glove, and from there you got coaches, you got trainers, you got strength coaches, you got a hitting coach. If you're a pitcher, you got a pitching coach, you got a position coach, you got field coaches, you got a head coach. There's probably a nutritionist, there's probably a sports psychologist. They tell you the bus leaves at 3. You just show up, you get on the bus, you go to the next game. You start at the bottom level. If you perform well, you move up to the next level. No matter what happens, you get a paycheck every week. Whether you go 5-for-5 or 0-for-5, you get a paycheck every week. Tennis player, it's not that way. The tennis player, you say, hey, I'm Ryan, I graduated from college, you know, you win the Van Nostrand Award, it might get, yeah, I know, maybe that came with a dollar or two to help you get started in a pro career, maybe not, but pretty much now you have to go out and play, and as the saying goes, you eat what you kill. You don't win, you don't eat. You got to make the schedule, you got to find the places to play, you got to see what the cutoffs are, you have to pay a coach if you have a coach, but then that's tricky because if you're not making any money, how do you pay a coach? What's it like trying to be an American out there and make your way early on as a player?
Well, whether you're American or from any other country, you know, I believe it's the same. We're fortunate in this country to have a number of professional opportunities in our backyard, but that's growing across the world. You know, worldwide, the sport of tennis is extremely popular, and, you know, the number of pro tournaments is seemingly increasing every single year in the international countries, in the foreign countries. But no, the lifestyle is you're right, it's tough, and, you know, you're going to small towns, whether it's in the U.S. or other, like I said, other countries, and you're battling against other very successful players for very small amount of money, very small amount of points, And you know, it's a tough life. It really is, and it's really ultra competitive. There are so many good players that even play the future level tournaments, and certainly the challenger level tournaments. Again, most of those guys are going to leave each week losing money at challengers, particularly like you said, if they have a coach. But even if not, you know, the expenses to get there, and even residual costs, health insurance, things like that. You know, that you don't really think about, that add up over time, and it's to take the level of competition, which is really, really strong, and to put it, you know, kind of in a blender, and you mix it in with the fact that you're not necessarily playing in the most glamorous locations, and you're not playing in front of too many people, but you're playing at a really, really high level. It can be tough, and you know, like I said, the biggest. Honestly, if you would ask me what the number one criteria is for between the guys that make it and the guys that don't, I always say it this way, that, you know, envision yourself losing a 7-6 in the third match with you know, five people in the stands watching, and you lost out first round, you made $300 for that week. Are you going to get motivated enough to wake up at 6 in the morning the next day and begin your training again for the next week? And do you love tennis that much? Are you committed to tennis that much? And when the answer is yes, then we encourage our guys to go out and play, because that's the right concoction, assuming they're in that pack of enough, having enough talent to be successful. It comes down to that desire. And yeah, you have extraordinary players. One in particular that I've been able to work with the last couple summers with the USTA is a kid named Mitchell Frank. And that kid's gonna make it because he has that desire, and you see that competitiveness, you see that love for the game. That's ultimately what it comes down to, because you're not playing for the external benefits immediately. You know, once you get up to the Grand Slam level, the tour event level, life becomes a lot more fun. Life becomes a lot more easy, and it's still real competitive, obviously, but the quality of life that you're living is much higher. But starting out there, it is difficult.
So what was the impetus for you? So you're out playing, you're doing your thing, you're trying to be a pro player. Why one day do you wake up and decide not to play anymore? You're still young. You had a lot of time ahead of you. What was the reason?
Sure. Well, for me, it was health reasons, number one. You know, I was really, really fortunate and lucky to have picture-perfect health, to be quite honest, through my college career. I never missed one college match, and I maybe sat out of one practice in 4 years. And same goes through my junior career as well. And I feel like it all just kind of caught up with me when I went out to play pro tennis. I broke my ankle 4 months into my pro career. That set me back for about 6 months by the time I got fully going again. And then I played for about a year and hit my career highs, which is pretty good to get to those numbers in a year. And I was really doing pretty well, and then I tore a ligament in my wrist. And from then on in, it was battling the tendonitis and the arthritis that came from that tear. And, you know, it was just sort of a cumulative effect of the injuries. And that's the ultimate reason why I stopped playing. But I knew also, too, that college tennis was what I loved the most. Of the three levels that I played, junior tennis, college tennis, pro tennis, college tennis, when you're representing something bigger than yourself, you're playing with teammates, you're playing with your brothers, you're playing with your best friends, obviously, it there's nothing better. And I knew I wanted to get back to this level on the coaching side of things, and so I felt like it was the right time for me to stop playing.
Well, Ryan, that's a good segue for us. We're going to talk about all things coaching in college tennis as soon as we come back. We're going to break real quickly here for a commercial, folks. This is Associate Head Coach Ryan Satchery on the Bruce Lipka Show today. Our call-in number, 714-583-6853. We've had a couple callers, and we got a couple email questions, Ryan, which we'll get back to after this. So stay with us, folks, while we jump real quick to this commercial. Back in 60 seconds.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike tennis camps and take your game to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
right, folks. Well,
folks, this is Ryan Satcher. If you're still listening, Coach Bruce Lipka, I think got cut off. He's calling back in a couple seconds, so hang on tight, and he'll be right back on. About 30 seconds.
Ryan, can you hear me?
I can, Bruce. Yep.
All right. Well, our phones went completely dead here in my office, so I'm cell phoning it now. So hopefully the cell phone here connection works out. Sorry about that, folks. Thanks for staying with us, Ryan. Thanks for quarterbacking this thing through that little technological glitch there. But coming back, you know, I think it's a great thing that happened because this reminds me of college coaching. College coaching, just like being a college player or tennis player, it's all about adapting and overcoming obstacles and figuring out problems and solving them. You know, what is it that made you to be attracted to want to do that for a living?
Well, you know what, you don't really think of the problems and things like that when you're envisioning a job. I think you think of the highlights and the potential opportunities to certainly impact the lives of the guys that you work with. And on you know, my side, I'm a men's coach, obviously, so I'm working with guys on a continuous basis. But and for me, honestly, I love my experience at Notre Dame. I love this university. I'm passionate about this place, and to be able to combine, you know, the sport that I love, the sport that I'm passionate about, the sport that I'm excited about, and to be able to do it at a place that that I share the same feelings for, is just an ultimate combination. And this is the destination I knew I always wanted to be back at, and work with Coach Bayless. And you know, now that I have the great fortune of taking over the program, I couldn't be more excited. My family's elated, and it really is an incredible situation for us.
And this is will the program under your reign look like it does under Coach Bayless's reign, or have you got some ideas or that you're waiting to unveil when the time comes?
Well, clearly the core of what we're going to be about is a tennis program. The core of what all sports programs, athletics programs at Notre Dame's are about is going to remain the same, you know, under my watch, and that is to have tremendous student-athletes who are both academically and motivated by their tennis as well, but motivated by their education, motivated by their tennis, and we have extremely high goals. We've always had the aspiration to compete for and ultimately win a national championship in this sport, and that's going to be something that is going to drive us, continue to drive us competitively, but we're going to do it with players that also, like I said, are serious about their education and want to be great people too. And, you know, we take pride in the maybe more holistic development of our student-athletes here at Notre Dame, both educationally and, you know, making an impact in the community. We have a great leadership academy here at Notre Dame that we try to develop, again, great leaders for the future. And that's what makes it fun. You're dealing with great kids, and you're competing at the highest level of the sport. And like I said, our aspirations and goals are going to be extremely, extremely high.
You know, going back to some of the experiences that you've had, you know, which I think we all bring our own perspective to everything. We all have a unique life experiences that cause our own filters, for lack of a better word, that we see the world through. when we talk about some of the experiences you had as a player and how they pertain to your profession, you know, one of the hot buttons for some years has been the international player in college tennis. And there are a lot of there's a lot of discussion about it, everything from, you know, and I had Coach Bayless and Coach Gould on my show last week, and we talked about it a little bit, but, you know, everything from, you know, maybe there should be a limit to, you know, international players can't receive more than, you know, a certain amount of scholarship money or be in a roster, a lineup similar to, you know, European club sports and basketball or Bundesliga, you know, talk Bundesliga tennis, one American or one non-German player. You know, what is the role of the international player in college tennis is my first question for you. Then after we answer that, my second question will be, I'll come with my second question. First, what do you see the role of the international player?
Well, you know, take my playing days, which was, you know, the late 90s. I graduated in 2000 from here, from Notre Dame, and then obviously my coaching career. This is my seventh year. So, you know, you take the last 15, 20 years or so, and I think that's I've been a part of the major increase with international players in college tennis. And from a playing perspective, I do see, you know, in general, I see it both ways. I certainly, and we're a program that, is going to remain steadfast in our commitment to recruit Americans and to develop players for our country and from our country. But by the same token, I do see the other side of the coin too, and I know from my own benefit. Again, as I referenced before, you know, I think a huge part of being successful on the pro tour is learning how to navigate playing international players because they're not the same as American players. There's definitely different styles, different personalities, different ways of competing that you can see across the board internationally. And you know, there's a different Swedish style from French style, from English style, and how those players handle themselves on the court too ranges and varies. And so I think from a player development standpoint, the ability to play against international competition in college was key for me. You know, it just opened my horizons, opened up my horizons a lot to what else is out there, and it did help me become a much better all around player than when I came to school. In terms of, like you talked about, caps and or scholarship limits placed on international players, you know, I have mixed emotions about it. I feel like each school, each university has its own mission. And I coached a year before I got back up here to Notre Dame at Baylor, where we had almost exclusively an international team. And Baylor, you know, catches a lot of flack, as do some of the other schools down south in the SEC and Big 12 for having high international population on their teams. But one of the core foundations of the school, one of the missions of the school, of Baylor University in general, was to increase its international population. So sometimes I feel like that maybe if you put a roster limit or scholarship cap on a school like that, where it's part of the institutional policy or part of the institutional desire to increase its international student population, I think you're maybe limiting you know, or kind of going against what the institution wants. From a American opportunity perspective, I think it's absolutely right on the money. So I'm sitting on the fence on that on purpose because I don't really know. I see both sides of the equation. I do know what I believe in, and that is that the best fits to be successful at Notre Dame are generally American kids. We have had some international players throughout Coach Bayless's tenure, and I will continue to look internationally as well a little bit. But to me, it comes down to the right fit. And I do feel an obligation, as I noted briefly, I did work for the USTA the last couple summers coaching the collegiate all-star team. And so I am committed to helping American tennis develop and grow. And I do see that as part of my job here. But also part of my job is to bring the best student athletes to Notre Dame that are going to be successful here and fit in well here and add to what we're trying to do here. And if it's an international student, then, you know, they'll go through a very, very, you know, high level of scrutiny by me and our staff. But if it works out where that's the best fit, then that's somebody that needs to be here.
Well, Coach Bayless has taught you well. You sit the fence as well as anyone we've ever seen. That's
a good answer. Well, truthfully, Bruce,
Let me change the question.
Sure.
I'll tell you where I stand on the thing. I don't have to sit on any fences anymore because I don't have to do politics. I have mixed feelings. One, that without the international player, You know, we'll take University of Virginia, for example. If all the juniors from the state of Virginia have to choose a school, and not everyone sees things the same, but if they're all competing for people, and there's William & Mary, there's the University of Virginia, there's Virginia Tech, there's the University of Richmond. Well, I don't think they have a team anymore, maybe. There's VCU in Richmond, a couple other schools also. There just aren't enough players necessarily to go around. And if someone has to choose, in today's world with the pressure on kids to get an education and get a job, they're trying to go to the highest academically ranked school. I'm going through with my kids right now. My daughter's been accepted to a couple colleges. The highest ranked one academically is the University of Florida. That's where she's leaning. I keep trying to explain to her it's more about the fit. Where do you fit in? Where will you enjoy yourself? But, of course, your children think that parents know nothing about anything. So I understand, you know, I don't know particularly about college and admissions. I know nothing, my children will tell you. So I understand. So on the one side, I see a need for the international player, but I want to change the question a little bit. We are the only country in the world that I can find, and I've looked high and low, that has amateur sport. No one else has amateur sport, not since the Olympics opened up. And the reason that we have amateur sport is because of the NCAA and because of college athletics. So in order to play in college, you know, if you go to Europe, there's lots of 15, 16-year-old kids who are playing professional basketball if they're good enough. They go to school in a different town. They go play for a different team because pro-amateur, there's no segregating the two in the European countries. So as a tennis player who traveled the world and a guy who's still very in touch with the international tennis community, is there an issue, forget of international players, but is there an issue amongst Americans, international, anyone, of some kids not maintaining really an amateur status before going to college to be a tennis player?
Absolutely. Absolutely there is. And yeah, you know, I'm just citing this as an example, but you're a 12-year-old kid in Spain. I'm not sure that they give trophies out to the 12-year-old national champion. I think they give a check. And you know, that's just the mentality across many foreign countries that, you know, a reward for doing well in a specific tournament or if you want to make the analogy to playing well in a game in another sport, you get paid. And that's just the way it is. And the whole notion of amateurism and whatnot isn't as prevalent in a lot of other countries as it is here. So yeah, it's a big deal. And I think the NCAA compliance office has made a smart decision to not necessarily scrutinize. You know, before the rule was you could take certain money as long as it you never exceeded your expenses in a given week. Now they've come up with a pretty blanket statement and said you can take money up to $10,000 basically throughout your entire career prior to enrolling in college, and as long as you didn't exceed that number, doesn't exceed 10 grand, then you're eligible as an amateur in the American college system. And you know, the thinking is that you're spending a heck of a lot more than $10,000 throughout someone's junior career, so their expenses couldn't possibly have been less than $10,000 if they're that good. And so anyways, I think that rule is pretty effective and makes a lot of sense and keeps it a lot more simple. But you know, I don't get too hung up on the advantage maybe the international kids have, because I think the mentality of amateurism is different. That doesn't necessarily mean just because they earned $5,000 total throughout their junior career, that doesn't mean that they're necessarily any better than the kid that's, you know, 15 in the southern section or you know, whatever it may be. And it's up to each individual college coach to determine which player they'd rather have on their team and which player can help benefit them the most. But in terms of having a competitive advantage, I don't necessarily look at it that way. Now, when you have guys that came in prior to this rule and more intense scrutiny from compliance offices, where kids were coming in, they made, you know, $50,000, $100,000 in their junior careers by playing pro tournaments and money tournaments and things like that. Now, that's a little bit different. But I like where it's at right now, and I think it's a pretty effective model.
Well, now take off your college coach hat and set it aside for a second, and let's put on our visionary goggles, you and I. And as a visionary, I would think to myself, if we really wanted to change the landscape of tennis and bring the U.S. back to being a prominent international presence in tennis. Back to the days when we had, you know, 30-plus players in the top 100, I would think that if we put money into junior tournaments, we may get even better athletes playing junior tournaments like they have in the European countries. I know lots of juniors in France who play tournaments in France, and they make a decent amount of money if they're good enough. Obviously, you don't win, you don't make any money. In Spain, it happens. In Germany, it happens. What if we were to do that in the U.S.? What if we went in that direction and junior tournaments on a weekend, instead of playing on a direct league basketball team where you just play and at the end of the season you got a trophy, what if you could win $100 or $250 in a weekend playing a tennis tournament? Would we start attracting a different type of athlete?
You might. You might. You honestly might. And that sounds like a ridiculous idea, but by the same token, I don't think it is ridiculous. What we have to find a way in the whole 10 and under tennis model, the concept of it, I think, is a brilliant one, because we've got to create, big picture, we've got to create, in my opinion, an incentive for Americans to play, American kids to play, more American kids to play tennis than currently do. You look at, and I referenced this a few minutes ago, but worldwide, tennis is the second most popular sport in the world behind soccer. In this country, it's something like the 20th most popular sport. And so we've got to create a way to get that number of being the second most popular sport in our country, at least approach that. And you know, I think adding a competitiveness to the game, to the sport, is what 10 and under tennis, in my opinion, the greatest benefit has done, is it's created tournaments for kids when they've only been playing for 3-4 months. Whereas when I grew up playing, you had to hit on the wall or you had to take lessons for 3 years before you could play your first tournament, before you were good enough. And so, you know, you're feeding the beast competitively. And then, yeah, to your point, the whole money concept, it adds an extra incentive to those that maybe need it. You know, if they're on the fence between playing football, basketball, or tennis, whatever we can create incentive-wise to get those kids that are maybe our greatest athletes in this country to go the tennis route, I think you're going to find an influx in the top 100 pros.
Well, I'll take it even a step further. My son, who plays lacrosse, and his summer coach actually plays for you guys. Your goalie, who went to the same high school as my son here, Georgetown Prep, your goalie up at Notre Dame, All-American, best goalie in the country. My son plays lacrosse. He aspires to it. And I say, well, you know what? What do you got next summer? And the lacrosse, they play tournaments, and there's a fee to play on a club. And he's got a $1,500 fee to play on the club team. And I said, that's great. You better get a job, and you better get out there and earn it. So from that point of view, you know, the lacrosse athlete, you know, they'll put a few hours in a day, and it's a different sport than tennis. Tennis, with the eye-hand coordination and the tactics, the individual nature of it, hitting your serves, doing the whole thing, it's a much longer day of preparation, the mental game. So I tell him he needs to go out and earn some money so he can get a job and he can go cut grasses and, you know, do some work here and there. But for the tennis player, I'm thinking the money in the junior tennis, if a kid could win $100 a week, you know, that pays for the tennis lesson. Helps mom and dad pay for the tech lesson, you know, builds money for a new, maybe they could do it where the kids don't actually get a check, but they get credit with the USTA, and the USTA can issue checks to certified, I don't know, coaches or something. Maybe there's some way, because it just feels like up here in the north where, you know, from Canfield, Ohio, you know what it's like, indoor court time costs money, belonging to the club costs money, you know, the lessons cost money, the clinics cost money. And the better you get, the more strings you're breaking. Drag your toe on your serve. Forget about that. You're getting new shoes every 3 weeks. You know, it seems like that could be a hindrance, you know, as well as opportunity, but cost. And that's one of the places I see that the money could be helpful as an incentive, but also as a, hey, you know what? This isn't a terrible thing, and it doesn't cost as much as it did. But, you know, maybe I see the world through rose-colored glasses. But at any rate, my second question is, you know, regarding coaching. At the college level, you first experienced on-court coaching in a match. When you went to Notre Dame and the coach could talk to you during the match, did your ability to receive coaching change from day one until graduation when you first were coached as a college player?
110%. I mean, it was, yeah, it's a big adjustment as a coach. I, I'm going through the process right now of you know, screening candidates to be my assistant coach moving forward this summer, from this summer on. And
I'll get my resume together. Don't worry.
I'd love to have you. But one of the conversations I was having with a candidate was about that, you know, and that there's sometimes, and I'm a pretty, again, if my personality would err on one side or the other, it would be on the do more as opposed to do less and aggressive side. And I've got to really tame myself with certain players on our team and not give them too much information overload. And because especially in what the what I see happen is when kids get to school, you really have to really pick and choose your time to talk to them because they're not used to that. They're only used to getting their own input. They're only and they're having, you know, running dialogues with themselves mentally throughout the entire of a course, you know, the entire course of a match. And so to be able to then top it off with an outside voice telling them something that maybe is uncomfortable for them to hear, even, hey, look, you've got to do X, Y, and Z. Well, I'm not too comfortable doing X, Y, and Z. That just might throw their emotions and their mental fragility out, you know, over the top.
Right.
And as a player, and I see that, like I said, with our players, certainly the ability to receive and process information as time goes on throughout someone's career increases. And so frequently what you'll see is with our more veteran players, we can pretty much have a dialogue with those guys after every point, you know, and really kind of talk out things and give strategy and give help and even address technical issues that are going on. But certainly you have to kind of ease your way into that. And what I frequently will do in the fall with kids, they don't know it that I'm doing it, but we'll be playing a fall tournament, and they'll be playing a match where, you know, ultimately what we want to win is dual matches, not necessarily every fall tournament match we play. I'll really try to go at them hard during a fall tournament just to see what they can take. And you really, you kind of get to you figure out what their threshold is of how much information is too much, so that when we get real in the spring and the dual matches come around, you know kind of what that line is and you don't cross it then, and it doesn't cost you in a match because maybe you overcoached them in the spring. You figured out where they can get to and what they can handle.
Well, I've always felt like my job as a tennis coach, you know, with the players at the club that I work with, you know, some of the best students I've ever had are not very good tennis players, but they're fantastic students. And I find that I can work with them till I'm blue in the face, but when you go out to play tennis, there's no coaching, and the wheels come off. So put your visionary goggles back on and gaze into a future of bigger game changer for me, in my opinion, to put America back to the forefront as an international tennis presence wouldn't be to add money to the juniors, would be to add coaching to the juniors so that the running dialogue in the head, you can train somebody of what that self-talk should sound like while they're under duress, while they're playing the match. You can create the dialogue that you want to be there and the thought patterns that need to be there, particularly under duress. And I think that changes, number one, the kids who we have playing, because kids don't want to – I mean, it's just not a lot of fun. You're out there. You're 12 years old. You're playing a match. It's 3 hours long. The kid's pushing. The kid's cheating. The kid's thising. The kid's thatting. The other parents in the back of the fence coaching. It's making you nuts. You're focused on everything except playing the match that you're involved with. And that can be due to brain development, maturity, the ability to focus, who knows what. But if we had coaching, even if it was just if young Ryan Satcher is at a tournament and young Bruce Lipka is his best friend from Canfield, and our mom dropped us off in the morning, and I just sat on the court and said, Ryan, that's it, hang in there, you're doing great. When you change ends, I'm like, you're doing great, keep playing, be consistent. You know, you're doing a great job. The kid's backhand might be weak, but, hey, just keep fighting hard. Just a positive voice. Not even necessarily the technical or tactical wizardry of a Coach Bayless, just getting someone out of their own head. What do you think that might do to the development of our tennis players?
Yeah, you know, I think it'd be unbelievably great. No question about it. I mean, you just look at, and I referenced it, you know, earlier when we were talking about the college tennis being the pathway to pros, and I do think you have some great coaches at this level, and so they're able to impart their wisdom not only during practices, but during live competition, like you were saying, on these players, and that can't help but help, you know, somebody develop exponentially, because again, a huge part of this game is the mental side of things. And as a junior coach, I spent 9 months working as a teaching pro in Columbus, Ohio, after I stopped playing the tour before I got into college coaching. And you know, again, I've been in your shoes where it's you work on something, and then they go out to play in a match, and it just all goes out the window. And I think a large the biggest reason for that most of the time is because the nerves take over, the anxiety takes over, and they don't know how to communicate with themselves when they're on the court. They don't know how to relax themselves when they're on the court. All those skills, really, we see that as college coaches, really can be developed. And if you begin that at a younger age, what an amazing difference, I think, in the level of junior play that we'll get. Now, I guess it all comes down to what you view the main responsibility of junior tennis, just as a big organization in general, as is it to develop players, or is it to create a fair system to let players kind of battle it out and whoever emerges victoriously? Because where I'm going with that is, obviously, those that have access and have the resources to hire great coaches, they're going to be at a competitive advantage when you put them out there compared to the kids that don't have the resources. And so you're kind of fixing it a little bit in regards to, you're slanting it towards the kids that can, again, can afford the great coaches and help them out. But that great coaching can really develop American tennis. And so it's sort of a catch-22 of what's the main purpose of junior tennis. And if it's to develop pros, then, yeah, absolutely, it should be done. There should be allowed to coach in junior ranks.
Well, I think the main purpose of junior tennis, for me at least, is it's nothing more than a vehicle to prepare kids for the rest of their life. It happens to be the vehicle that I use to mentor and to help kids prepare for life. But along the way, laying a foundation that should they turn out to have a greater skill level than anybody anticipated, at least they wouldn't be capped anywhere because they haven't been prepared to grow to their potential. But I'll answer your other question or your other point about resources. I'm not so sure that just because, and I don't know who the great coaches are, but I'll tell you this. I'll take a college kid who just graduated from college and is enthusiastic and passionate. I'll take you, you know, after you're done playing tennis and you have no coaching credentials, I'd take a guy like you that I could pay a lot less money and put you on the court with my kid to coach him in a match than I would take Robert Lansdorf to coach my kid in a match, or Nick Bollettieri, who gets, you know, $1 million an hour and has been around forever. Because I think the match coaching is about, number one, the connection, as what you were talking about, where you're trying to find out from your kids what they're capable of handling, what they're not. But more importantly, it's about understanding what's going on out there. You know what it's like sitting out there. And, you know, I find that my greatest attribute as a coach, I don't know if I was any good or not, but I thought my best attribute was I was still playing. And I knew how difficult it was for my kid when he stepped up there and he was serving, and it was 4-all matches, and the last doubles match was on, and he was serving at 4-5 in the third. You know, I see a lot of coaches yell at the kid, just hit the first serve and just make a serve. What are you doing? And I'm thinking to myself, my God, I can even hardly breathe when I'm in that situation. So taking somebody who's, you know, thoroughly in touch with the experience might be more valuable than being able to afford a better coach. And like I say, even if you and I are practice partners and we play together a lot, I mean, what better deal than having your best buddy who you really can communicate with you? So I don't know if we'll ever get to that someday, but I certainly think that would change the landscape of where we could go with tennis.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think it's definitely something that any player that's played college tennis will tell you that it's helped their development, I'm sure, and it clearly can help junior players develop at a quicker rate too.
So what's the plan here moving forward? Outline for me, what does the future look like? Coach Bayless retires, you hire an assistant. Then what goes on? Anything changing? It's all the same.
You know, I've had some conversations with Ramsey Smith, who's at Duke. He's the current head coach at Duke, was in my exact position, played at Duke, was the assistant at Duke, promoted up to head coach. Cedric Kaufman, who's at Kentucky, again, same exact situation as me. And, you know, it was funny because I asked him, I said, you know, what changes? And, you know, each program's different. There's little nuances that you see, and certainly we're going to do some things differently than what Coach Bayless has done here. But like I said, the main core principles of which our program is founded on are going to remain the same, and they'll always be the same, no matter who the coach is. But their input to me was that it doesn't really change that much. You know, when you're embedded in a program to the extent that I am here at Notre Dame, and even in my current role as associate head coach, or which is a glorified way of saying assistant coach, you know, I bleed blue and gold, and just like those guys bled for Duke and Kentucky respectively. And you know, when you have that passion, you have that concern, you have that caring, it doesn't change. A title doesn't change that. And you know, certainly which decisions to be made, and ultimately it falls on you now to make that decision. That's certainly maybe a bit of an added pressure that we'll feel. But it was interesting to get their perspective, because they to a man, they both said that it's a slightly different, the overall feeling does not change. And you know, I'm ecstatic about the opportunity. And like I said, we will make some minor tweaks to how we do things, maybe look at our schedule a little bit differently. And that's going to be made for us. That decision's going to be made for us as we join the ACC now moving forward. And,
yep.
You know, the Big East has been an incredible home for all of our Olympic sports, and especially men's tennis. And, you know, we're going to miss some of the rivalries there and the experiences and opportunities that the Big East has provided. But gosh, to be able to go to the arguably, you know, one of the top two tennis conferences in the country and you know, live that life with down in ACC country is going to be awesome. And you know, one of the negatives about the Big East is we've never had a mandatory round robin league schedule in the regular season. So while we played a conference tournament at the end of the year, there was never that build up throughout the year. Whereas in the ACC, we're going to be able to experience that now really provide a great experience for our student athletes.
How many matches will you be adding? Well, how many teams will you be playing in the future that you do not currently play?
That's a great question. When it's all said and done, once Notre Dame and Louisville make our moves to the ACC, there'll be 13 teams in that conference to play men's tennis. So obviously you don't play yourself, so we play 12 other teams. Currently on our schedule, we currently have Louisville, Duke, and Wake on our schedule. So we'll be playing an addition of nine new teams to the schedule. And
so
in years past, we've played...
Outgo the Big Ten schools you typically play are out, and the ACC schools
no.
are in, huh?
No, we're still going to play some of our regional rivals. I mean, we're really fortunate in this whole circumstance because, you know, most schools, really every other school except for where we're going to be in this new situation we'll be in, every other school is located in driving distance of its conference opponents, and so they have to go outside for their outside of their region and fly and travel far distances to play their out of conference schedule. We're sort of the opposite. You know, we'll be traveling a ton in conference, but you know, heck, when you have Ohio State, Michigan, Illinois, Northwestern, you know, you got great regional. Kentucky is another great driving distance opponent that we can build a phenomenal out of conference schedule and never leave our backyard, never leave a bus. And so you know, that's sort of the plan that I have, and continue to play as many regional teams as I can, play the ACC schools, and then you know, on spring break we'll go somewhere fun, either California, Florida, Texas, somewhere in there, and you know, maybe change that up every single year and give our guys again a different experience so that it's not the same mundane thing every single year. But that's pretty much how our schedule is going to look like moving forward.
Well, you know, I have a year of eligibility left because I was hurt 1 year and I graduated early. If I get the NCAA to give it back to me, I might could help you at seven doubles if they ever add seven doubles. I'm excited. And I come play.
Well,
I'll
tell
you
what, we take your passion, we take your passion, your enthusiasm, your energy, and I think we can make something work there. That's a deal. If you can get that extra year, come on board.
I've got some of my best buddies are fellow domers of yours. You know, Jim Kilway, who played for Coach Bayless when he first arrived, and Calvis, who played and coached there, and you know, Matt Scott, who's a guy who I coached to play for,
yep,
Coach Bayless. Now Danny Stahl's in my area here, so I spent,
yep,
a fair bit of time with him. And, you know, the school's turned out some of the finest people I know, and I'm sure under your tutelage they will continue to excel as both human beings and tennis players. And I think it's great, and look forward to watching the program progress as you move forward.
Well, Bruce, can't thank you enough for saying that. You know, and all the people you reference are great, great people. And I don't know Jim all that well, but you know, BK and Matt Scott and Dan Stahl, you know, three of my favorite and three of the best that have come out of Notre Dame. And you know, again, we're just fortunate that we are able to attract great kids, and our current team is loaded with unbelievable people, and the culture within our program right now is super healthy, and it makes it, you know, I feel guilty calling it work. You know, it makes it fun to come into the office every single day and work with these guys and try to produce the best product we can during their 4 years here, and ultimately develop them into the best people so that they can lead others and be successful in life after college is over.
Well, Ryan, I think you're going to do a great job. I wish you all the best of luck. I thank you for coming on and spending an hour with us today. And I know you got a bunch of stuff to do, so we will let you run, and we look forward to watching the progress of the program under your guidance.
Well, it was a great time, and anytime you want me on, I'd love to do it again, and really appreciate the opportunity. And as always, you know, best of luck to you. You were, and I mean this with all sincerity, you were a big influence on my life, even though we had just pretty much a phone relationship. But again, I learned a lot from talking with you and seeing how you operated your program, and try to emulate your level of enthusiasm and energy every single day into what I do. And you know, again, really appreciate you having me on, and I had a great time.
Well, I thank you for that, Ryan, and it's super to hear, and I wish you guys the best of luck for the rest of the season. Y'all take care.
Okay, thanks, Bruce. Thanks.
Okay. Folks, that's our show today. That was Ryan Satry, who, former great U.S. player, great college player, pro player. Unfortunately, a couple injuries got in his way, but heck of a great young man. Going to be leading one of the finest programs in the country moving forward. Hope you'll join us next week. We'll have a great show for you again. Let's get out there and hit some tennis balls.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.